3. A popular song from the 50s suggests that love makes the world go round, but coincidence would probably be a better bet. Rufus Dearborn, who was staying that night in room 1414 up near the elevators, was a salesman for the Singer Sewing Machine Company, in town from Texas to talk about moving up to an executive position. And so it happened that 90 or so years after room 1408's first occupant jumped to his death, another sewing machine salesman saved the life of the man who had come to write about the purportedly haunted room. Or perhaps that is an exaggeration. Mike Enslin might have lived even if no one, especially a fellow on his way back from a visit to the ice machine, had been in the hallway at that moment. Having your shirt catch fire is no joke, though, and he certainly would have been burned much more severely and extensively if not for Dearborn, who thought fast and moved even faster. Not that Dearborn ever remembered exactly what happened. He constructed a coherent enough story for the newspapers and TV cameras. He liked the idea of being a hero very much, and it certainly did no harm to his executive aspirations. And he clearly remembered seeing the man on fire lunge out into the hall, but after that, everything was a blur. Thinking about it was like trying to reconstruct the things you had done during the vilest, deepest drunk of your life. One thing he was sure of, but didn't tell any of the reporters because it made no sense. The burning man's scream seemed to grow in volume, as if he were a stereo that was being turned up. He was right there in front of Dearborn, and the pitch of the scream never changed, but the volume most certainly did. It was as if the man were some incredibly loud object that was just arriving here. Dearborn ran down the hall with the full ice bucket in his hand. The burning man, it was just his shirt on fire, I saw that right away, he told the reporters, struck the door opposite the room he had come out of, rebounded, staggered, and fell to his knees. That was when Dearborn reached him. He put his foot on the burning shoulder of the screaming man's shirt and pushed him over onto the hall carpet. Then he dumped the contents of the ice bucket onto him. These things were blurred in his memory, but accessible. He was aware that the burning shirt seemed to be casting far too much light, a sweltering yellow-orange light that made him think of a trip he and his brother had made to Australia 2 years before. They had rented an all-wheel drive and had taken off across the Great Australian Desert. The few natives called it the Great Australian Bugger-All, the Dearborn brothers discovered. A hell of a trip. Great, but spooky. Especially the big rock in the middle, Ayers Rock. They had reached it right around sunset, and the light on its many faces was like this, hot and strange, not really what you thought of as earthlight at all. He dropped beside the burning man, who was now only the smoldering man, the covered with ice cubes man, and rolled him over to stifle the flames reaching around to the back of the shirt. When he did, he saw the skin on the left side of the man's neck had gone a smoky, bubbly red, and the lobe of his ear on that side had melted a little. But otherwise... otherwise... Dearborn looked up, and it seemed... this was crazy, but it seemed the door to the room the man had come out of was filled with the burning light of an Australian sundown, the hot light of an empty place where things no man has ever seen might live. It was terrible, that light, and the low buzzing, like an electric clipper that was trying desperately to speak. But it was fascinating, too. He wanted to go into it. He wanted to see what was behind it. Perhaps Mike saved Dearborn's life as well. He was certainly aware that Dearborn was getting up, as if Mike no longer held any interest for him, and that his face was filled with the blazing, pulsing light coming out of 1408. He remembered this better than Dearborn later did himself, but of course, Rufe Dearborn had not been reduced to setting himself on fire in order to survive. Mike grabbed the cuff of Dearborn's slacks.
"Don't go in there," he said in a cracked, smoky voice. "You'll never come out."
Dearborn stopped, looking down at the reddening, blistering face of the man on the carpet.
"It's haunted," Mike said.
And as if the words had been a talisman, The door of room 1408 slammed furiously shut, cutting off the light, cutting off the terrible buzz that was almost words. Rufus Dearborn, one of Singer Sewing Machine's finest, ran down to the elevators and pulled the fire alarm. 4. There's an interesting picture of Mike Enslin in Treating the Burn Victim, a Diagnostic Approach, the 16th edition of which appeared about 16 months after Mike's short stay in room 1408 of the Hotel Dolphin. The photo shows just his torso, but it's Mike all right. One can tell by the white square on the left side of his chest. The flesh all around it is an angry red, actually blistered into second-degree burns in some places. The white square marks the left breast pocket of the shirt he was wearing that night, the lucky shirt, with his mini-quarter in the pocket. The mini-quarter itself melted around the corners, but it still works, and the tape inside it was fine. It's the things on it which are not fine. After listening to it 3 or 4 times, Mike's agent, Sam Farrell, tossed it into his wall safe, refusing to acknowledge the goose flesh all over his tanned, scrawny arms. In that wall safe, the tape has stayed ever since. Farrell has no urge to take it out and play it again, not for himself, not for his curious friends, some of whom would cheerfully kill to hear it. New York publishing is a small community, and word gets around. He doesn't like Mike's voice on the tape. He doesn't like the stuff that voice is saying. My brother was actually eaten by wolves one winter on the Connecticut Turnpike. What in God's name is that supposed to mean? And most of all, he doesn't like the background sounds on the tape, a kind of liquid smooshing that sometimes sounds like clothes churning around in an oversudsed washer, sometimes like one of those old electric hair clippers, and sometimes, weirdly, like a voice. While Mike was still in the hospital, a man named Olin, the manager of the goddamned hotel, if you please, came and asked Sam Farrell if he can listen to that tape. Farrell said no, he couldn't. What Olin could do was take himself on out of the agent's office at a rapid hike and thank God all the way back to the flea bag where he worked that Mike Enslin had decided not to sue either the hotel or Olin for negligence. I tried to persuade him not to go in, Olin said quietly. A man who spent most of his working days listening to tired travelers and petulant guests bitch about everything from their rooms to the magazine selection in the newsstand, he wasn't much perturbed by Farrell's rancor. I tried everything in my power. If anyone was negligent that night, Mr. Farrell, it was your client. He believed too much in nothing. Very unwise behavior. Very unsafe behavior. I would guess he has changed somewhat in that regard. In spite of Farrell's distaste for the tape, he would like Mike to listen to it, acknowledge it, perhaps use it as a pad from which to launch a new book. There is a book in What Happened to Mike. Farrell knows it. Not just a chapter, a 40-page case history, but an entire book, one that might outsell all 3 of the 10 Nights books combined. And of course he doesn't believe Mike's assertion that he has finished not only with ghost tales, but with all writing. Writers say that from time to time, that's all. The occasional prima donna outburst is part of what makes writers in the first place. As for Mike Enslin himself, he got off lucky, all things considered, and he knows it. He could have been burned much more badly than he actually was. If not for Mr. Dearborn and his bucket of ice, he might have had 20 or even 30 different skin graft procedures to suffer through instead of only 4. His neck is scarred on the left side in spite of the grafts, but the doctors at the Boston Burn Institute tell him the scars will fade on their own. He also knows that the burns, painful as they were in the weeks and months after that night, were necessary. If not for the matches with "close cover before striking" written on the front, he would have died in 1408, and his end would have been unspeakable. To a coroner, it might have looked like a stroke or a heart attack, but the actual cause of death would have been much nastier. Much nastier. He was also lucky in having produced 3 popular books on ghosts and hauntings before actually running afoul of a place that is haunted, This he also knows. Sam Farrell may not believe Mike's life as a writer is over, but Sam doesn't need to. Mike knows it for both of them. He cannot so much as write a postcard without feeling cold all over his skin and being nauseated deep in the pit of his belly. Sometimes just looking at a pen or a tape recorder will make him think, "The pictures were crooked. I tried to straighten the pictures." He doesn't know what this means. He can't remember the pictures or anything else from room 1408, and he is glad. That is a mercy. His blood pressure isn't so good these days. His doctor told him that burn victims often develop problems with their blood pressure and put him on medication. His eyes trouble him. His optometrist told him to start taking Ocuvites. He has consistent back problems. His prostate has gotten too large. But he can deal with these things. He knows he isn't the first person to escape 1408 without really escaping. Olin tried to tell him. But it isn't all bad. At least he doesn't remember. Sometimes he has nightmares, quite often, in fact. Almost every goddamn night, in fact. But he rarely remembers them when he wakes up. A sense that things are rounding off at the corners, mostly. Melting the way the corners of his mini-quarter melted. He lives on Long Island these days, and when the weather is good, he takes long walks on the beach. The closest he has ever come to articulating what he does remember about his 70-odd, very odd, minutes in 1408 was on one of those walks. "It was never human," he said to the incoming waves in a choked, halting voice. "Ghosts, at least ghosts, were once human. The thing in the wall, though, that thing..." Time may improve it. He can and does hope for that. Time may fade it, as it will fade the scars on his neck. In the meantime, though, he sleeps with the lights on in his bedroom, so he will know at once where he is when he wakes up from the bad dreams. He has had all the phones taken out of the house. At some point, just below the place where his conscious mind seems able to go, he is afraid of picking the phone up and hearing a buzzing, inhuman voice spit, "This is 9. 9. We have killed your friends. Every friend is now dead." And when the sun goes down on clear evening, he pulls every shade and blind and drape in the house. He sits like a man in a dark room until his watch tells him the light, even the last fading glow along the horizon, must be gone. He can't stand the light that comes at sunset. That yellow deepening to orange, like light in the desert.